Hello, my name's Brian Dwyer. This is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. With me, Lee Kelly. How are you, Lee?
Hi, Brian. I'm very well.
It's a kind of a Jane Austen day, really, yes. Isn't it?
I did think I should have worn my bonnet, really, today.
Sort of day where you stay inside unless you're Marianne Dashwood. And she's always going off into storms and catching a chill. We are speaking today about the novels of Jane Austen. But before we get to the lovely Jane Austen, I have to tell you I've been reading a crime book during the week.
Oh.
And kind of really enjoyed it. It's Silver Meadow by Barry Maitland. And it's a bit of a satire on the shopping plaza, for a start, because all the
it's
action...
It's a place ripe for satire, if ever there was one.
Yeah, nearly all the action takes place in this massive shopping plaza, and, of course, the narrative voice just makes fun of, all the superficiality of it and everything. And he introduces a phrase which will be familiar to our listeners, the Gruen transfer.
Oh, yes.
which is the phenomenon of getting people to shop, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he talks about all the tricks they have to get you to shop.
Mm.
And he has his hero is a gentle detective, inspector or something, Brock. And Brock's sidekick is a smart young woman called Kathy. So they have many personal and professional adventures.
In the shopping plaza.
In the shopping plaza.
I did read the paper the other day that Chadstone in Melbourne, the large shopping centre in the Southern Hemisphere or something, has just reopened some refurbished part and people queued for hours. To get into the new bit.
To see it.
And you do wonder, are we missing
it's
something?
It's kind of get a life territory, isn't it, really? Maybe they were queuing to buy a book. Maybe. It's been a big week for poetry.
Yes. Lee,
with Bob Dylan announced as the Nobel laureate for literature.
There was some wag said in the paper, writer said, does that mean I'm eligible for a Grammy?
Well, I think it's a good thing. He's certainly a great poet, Dylan, I think. So I'm very pleased to see him. To see the popular song recognised.
It's interesting though, isn't it? I mean, I was watching the lady, should know her name but don't, who was making the announcement, and I was thinking, there's always a danger, isn't there, that you you represent the world according to how you know it. Your cultural reference points, etc. And, I felt like when she was saying that she was talking about her memory of Dylan. And what he meant to her, because she's the right demographic, people that were sort of growing into political consciousness in the 60s and so forth. She seemed, and I just wondered whether that was the only thing I thought. I wasn't worried about the fact that it was a song. I just wonder whether it seems such a strange thing to give to Dylan now.
Yes. Well, I'm sure every judging panel has its biases.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, maybe there is. Maybe there's a political dimension to it as well, And they do tend to spread it around a bit, don't they, the Nobel Prize? I mean, there's every couple of years there's an African and there,
And whatever. They've spoken about that, that desire to make sure that poetry as a genre is represented, because it's easy to get clouded by the fabulous novels that they're presented with.
And speaking of fabulous novels, you've started on The Bandle, The Untouchable.
Yes, my reading, I can't get into new territory, Brian. I just keep coming home from this show every week with more and more things to read. I'm going to get killed by the books on the side of my bed one day.
I do too. And after last week's show, when you and Deb and Kathy were talking about Atkinson.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I haven't even gone there. No. But I did want to go back and read John Banville's The Untouchables because you and Deb were very complimentary of it, and I have just loved it.
Yeah.
But I was saying off air, I read a review of John Banville that was done on another of his novels, The Sea, the one that won the Pulitzer Prize, and the person wrote a very, very articulate piece about the power of him as a writer.
Wow.
And but she did say you have to have the dictionary beside you. And it's quite interesting because I remember having a pact with myself that when you read, you know how, I mean, when we teach kids to read, you always talk about, you know, the context. It doesn't really, the particular word may not be so important if you can work out the context around it.
Yeah.
You know, and don't break your rhythm by worrying about that. But it is sort of important if you come across words, particularly at our age, that you don't know the meaning of, because it's now or never.
Well, that's what the post-it note was invented for. So you can go back later and look
for it. Yeah, and add it. Mm. But there was about five when I was reading last night, but one of them was he talked about carpulence. I think that's what it was. Is that what I said?
Crapulence.
Crapulous, feeling crapulous.
Crapulous.
And it is actually meaning when you over-imbibe in food or alcohol. It has to be the origin of the word crap, I think.
Has to be. I wonder if he doesn't just amuse himself by doing that.
Yeah, well, that's right. There was another one that I looked up. I can't even remember what it was now, but it just meant close by. And I thought, well, you could have just said close by, really. It's not one of those words that, you know, gives you any visual sort of image. It's not like it needed to be perfect for the occasion. But anyway, it's still, I mean, it's in character in that book, because this is a book, of course, about thinly veiled, about Anthony Blunt.
Romana Clef.
Yeah. Of, you know, the Queen's art...
Curator,
who was later found out to be one of the spies in the sort of Cambridge spy circle, the last one. And I remember the fuss when he was revealed.
Yes, was Margaret Thatcher who announced that government circles had known for some time, but the public had not known.
Mm.
Yes.
Anyway,
Banville's, I think, the most stylish writer I've read. It is, as you say, it's a pleasure just to get through the sentence. It's a pleasure.
I'll have to read something else he's written though, because it's very in character, because the character of Victor in the book is a very well educated academic. So the crispness and the sort of wide-ranging vocabulary very much suits that character.
Yes,
I don't know how it translates to another
good point. Book. Yes. All right. We're going to move on to Jane Austen. Lee Kelly, in 2008, a survey of more than 15,000 Australian readers found that Pride and Prejudice came first in a list of the 101 best books ever written. She's certainly very, very popular. Jane Austen was born in 1775, died in 1817. Her works critique the sentimental novels of the second half of the 18th century and are part of the transition, apparently, to 19th century literary realism. And her plots always highlight women's traditional dependence on marriage to secure social standing and economic security.
And you know how they always say to writers, write about what you know. Well, this is the funny part about Jane Austen, because she never married. And yet marriage was such a dominant theme in all her books.
Yes, and the making good match, a good match, and trying to find that balance between sensibly marrying somebody who can provide for you, but not marrying for money.
The female characters chafing in that sort of tension between those two things.
I read in a philosophy magazine some comments by a man called Thomas Rodham, published in 2013. We should read Jane Austen today because she is wise as well as clever, and because she teaches us how to live well. The omniscient author of her books sees right through people to their moral character and then exposes and dissects their follies, flaws, and self-deceptions.
That's actually very apt, isn't it? Because all of her characters have those, they have features of the most sort of base instincts in human beings, yes, as well as the most sort of redeeming factors and the sort of the pettiness of human beings, as well as their glorious features.
Yes, they do. Now, you're not familiar with Sense and Sensibility.
No.
Let me just say something about it because it's kind of fresh in my mind because I saw the Emma Thompson movie just the other day.
Well, actually, that's a point. If you want to say anything about the popularity of Jane Austen, just go and have a look at many miniseries and TV shows and movies that are made either recreating the actual text or else updating them so they're a modern parallel. It's incredible.
And there's a modern Sense and Sensibility published by Johanna Trollope in 2013 called Sense and Sensibility, a novel, part of the Jane Austen project by some publishing company. And I've got some lovely ones. Here's Dear Jane Austen, which is a heroine's guide to life and love, in which people write to Jane Austen for advice. It's just wonderful. It's wonderful. And another one, and this is The Wicked Wit of Jane Austen, and it's quotations from her letters to her sister Cassandra, and quotations from the novels. And it's just a delightful read. The Wit of Jane Austen.
Well, there are certainly some really funny parts in her novels. You know, that it's not what they're renowned for, but there are some very funny parts.
Yes. She is wonderful. Sense and Sensibility was written actually early. She read her novels to her family. There's a bit of a sort of apocryphal myth about her having to hide her writing under the tablecloth, but she, since she had been a child, she'd amused her parents and her siblings with her writing, and she was a prolific author as a teenager. And for instance, she wrote A History of England when she was 13 or 14.
And a lot of her books were, she actually rewrote, you know. She changed titles and she does all the things that, fabulous things that writers are supposed to do, editing their own work.
Yes, by hand.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Anyway, she had read Sense and Sensibility to her family before 1796, but it wasn't published until 1811. It was the first of her books to be published anonymously, Sense and Sensibility by a lady. It's about the Dashwood sisters, Eleanor and Mary Ann. And, of course, one is sensible and one is sensible in the arty sense, you know. And it's like a philosophical treatise about whether you should indulge your emotions or repress them. It is a wonderful book, wonderful. The sisters and their poor mother are impoverished. Their brother, of course, has inherited the estate.
Yes, that's a very common
and he's very
bugbear of Jane Austen's.
His very unpleasant wife has turfed them out on a very modest pension. So they go off to live somewhere else in a cottage. And Marianne, of course, falls in love with a neighbouring man, Willoughby. And now Willoughby seems to her to match her prejudice of what a hero should be. She has this idea in her head, and Willoughby matches her preconception, so she falls madly in love with him. Unhappily, the man's a cad. Eleanor falls in love with a very gentle vicar who is disinherited by his family, can't find a job, and is unhappily already engaged to somebody else. So the story is about the heroines finding their way to true love in the end. She invented the romantic comedy, I think, Jane Austen. And the other characters, William Ferrers is a very worthy but very modest vicar whom Eleanor loves. Colonel Brandon's the very worthy, generous, highly principled neighbour who is besotted by Marianne and whom she doesn't notice until...
She's worked her way through a number of other things.
Yes, she's worked her way through the fantasy. And, of course, there are so many other little minor characters who are tactless or selfish or scheming or mean-spirited, and it's a wonderful, wonderful book.
I did read that, which I was surprised about, but it's probably obvious to everybody, that before Jane Austen, most famous female fictional characters were created by men.
Yes.
You know, she was the one who was a woman writing about a woman's perspective.
Yes.
It's interesting too that when you listen to the plots of them, you think, gosh, there's a lot of characters and a lot going on, and that doesn't seem very, you know, logical, that, you know, coincidences and things like that happen. But when you're reading them, because she holds the central character so close to her, you actually, it's like a life. You meet people in your life, and it's like that. So you don't get confused, you know?
No, it's wonderful. They're wonderfully constructed. So her narrator is this omniscient third-person narrator, but she's famous for that free indirect discourse in which she attributes thoughts to the character. It's a wonderful technique, and it's a characteristic of her novels. The second of her novels to be published in 1813 was Pride and Prejudice, which she had...
The biggie.
Yes, the big one. Which she had as a working title, First Impressions. It's interesting that I always thought, oh, well, Darcy's the proud one and Elizabeth's guilty of some prejudice. But in fact, they're both proud and they're both prejudiced, aren't they?
That's right.
Yes, so for people who don't know, Mr. and Mrs. Bennet... have been married in perhaps a foolish passion 23 years earlier.
Do you know what we should do, Brian, though? We should read the first line, because that is the key to this book.
It is.
So it is the truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
I'm surprised you even had to open the book.
Like, I wanted to get it right, Brian.
Remembered that.
I tend to muddle things up and get a few things out of order.
Unhappily for Mr. Bennet, he has five unmarried daughters. So it's a very rich comedy about getting them all married off. A couple of eligible young men move into the neighbourhood, Mr. Bingley and his friend, his haughty friend, Mr. Darcy. Bingley, of course, falls in love with Jane, the pure oldest sister. Wasn't she played delightfully in that BBC TV series with Jennifer Eale as Elizabeth and Colin Firth as Darcy? I don't know the name of the actress who played Jane, but she was
I know. She's I know her face. I can see it.
She was like a saintly persona. And But Bingley is dissuaded from marrying beneath his status by his proud friend, Darcy. And so there are all kinds of obstacles in the way of Elizabeth finding true love with the wealthy Mr. Darcy. It is lovely. And you spoke about comic characters. I love that. Lady Catherine de Bourgh.
Yes.
Darcy's aunt, who of course has somebody earmarked for him.
Yes. And now that's her daughter. She wants Darcy to marry her daughter.
And she takes great exception to Miss Bennet's presuming.
And the character of Mrs. Bennet herself, you know.
Oh, like, yes.
She just, you know, you can look at this book and think, why would all these people in 2009 vote it as the number one?
Yeah.
And you can say, oh, well, yeah, a lot of girls get completely carried away with Pride and Prejudice because they're always on lists and stuff at school. But it is so much more than that. It's more than the romance. The characters are genuinely sort of, they're so different from one another. They're multi-layered. There's some extremely funny ones. You know, it's just got so much in it. Like the character of Mrs. Bennet, she's that sort of person that you can imagine, you know, you're in a room and they're yabbering on and you're blushing for them.
Yeah.
You know? Does you feel like she's, that when you read?
She's the embarrassing mum who says entirely inappropriate things when you have guests over. And she's so self-pitying she has to go and have a lie down.
Drama queen.
Yeah, she is. And there's a lovely quote here. Mr. Bennet had so odd a mixture of quick parts, sarcastic humour, reserve and caprice that the experience of 23 years had been insufficient to make his wife understand his character. She's adult, let's face it.
And Lizzie often have jokes and just like straight over the head.
So Lizzie, of course, is his favourite daughter. Jane's a saintly older one. And then the others are Kitty and Lydia, who are both extremely silly.
Yeah.
And Mary, who's extremely dull. And Mary insists on playing the piano for guests. And Mr. Bennet says, "Mary, my dear, you have delighted us long enough." And look, here's this famous passage when Darcy, despite the fact that the Bennet family are so socially inferior to him, finds that he can't get Elizabeth out of his mind because she's so spirited and intelligent and amusing and everything. And he proposes to her. And here's her reply. "From the very beginning, from the first moment, I may almost say, of my acquaintance with you, your manners impressing me with the fullest belief in your arrogance, your conceit, and your selfish disdain of the feelings of others, were such as to form that the groundwork of disappropriation on which succeeding events have built so immovable a dislike, and I had not known you a month before I felt you were the last man in the world whom I could ever be prevailed upon to marry."
Take that!
Isn't that brilliant?
I actually, I've got an essay from Helen Garner's recently published book, Everywhere I Look, which is Helen Garner. I can't resist her. She's one of my favourites.
Oh, yes.
But she refers to that same event. And this essay is called How to Marry Your Daughters. Uh-huh. And it's basically the story of how she decides that she's going to go and revisit Pride and Prejudice because she has loved it for such a long time. And she wonders whether it will still hold the attraction. You know, what is it about it that that got her so enamoured with it? So she starts off reading it, and then as she goes through, she's writing about how she's feeling. And she, in the end, she says, right, that's it. I'm moving to the sofa and I've closed the curtains, put on the air conditioner, buckle your seatbelts, I'm going to finish it. But she does this bit, I'll read this bit where she talks about that particular moment where Darcy's proposed and Elizabeth absolutely refuses him. So it came as a surprise to me that Mr. Darcy makes Elizabeth his first proposal, which she repels in a scene of breathtaking muscle and spark on page 210. Wasn't this rather premature? Had she hung out the flags of love too soon? I tilted the book and examined its profile exactly halfway. The cunning minx. She was going to make me wait another 218 pages for a resolution, torn between despair and violent longing. I was obliged to rise from my sofa and take a turn around the drawing room.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, of course, what Elizabeth learns is that despite his faults, Darcy's a man of great principle and generosity and devotion and loyalty. And she discovers this, of course, because her foolish sister, Lydia runs away with the cad.
Yes, the Wickham. Cad. Wickham.
Who had, of course, taken an interest in Elizabeth early on in the piece.
And she had she had attacked Darcy about the way he treated Wickham. She'd just fallen for what Wickham had told her, hook, line and sinker.
Mm. So Darcy comes through in the end, and Elizabeth, of course, and Darcy is encouraged by the fact that Elizabeth stands up to his horrible auntie, Lady Catherine de Bourgh, and having rescued Lydia, and then he makes bold enough to make her acquaintance again.
I think, the thing about that is, haven't we all been in that situation where you've made a catastrophic error of judgment? I mean, anyone who's been married once or twice probably talk about that. And it just captures that moment so beautifully when Elizabeth realises that she's been sucked in, basically.
Yes.
But, you know, that happens. Yes. You know, you think that you've got, you're approaching things with your eyes wide open, but all the prejudices that you have are really impacting on the way that you judge people.
Yes.
And I think that's, apart from the romance, it's one of the really interesting parts of the book that it puts you in that situation and you...
And Jane Austen, of course, is as relevant today as she was in 1811.
Oh, yes. So shall we introduce our little game, Brian?
Oh, yes.
You'll have to vote,
yes.
I think.
Yes.
So what we did, our little game, was in our desperate desire to talk about how relevant Pride and Prejudice still is, we tried to think of characters who would be the modern equivalents in the novel. So if we start with Darcy, I thought there was trouble with this character because there are a lot of people who look like they will be Mr. Darcy and then they let you down.
Yeah.
You know, someone who's well-heeled but admirable and like you say, loyal, etc. So I thought, 12 months ago, maybe people might have said Malcolm Turnbull.
Malcolm Turnbull was Mr. Darcy,
but no way now. And then I thought...
More of a Willoughby, I think.
Yeah. I thought of Tony Jones.
Q&A.
Because he's like that, isn't he? But he's not quite haughty enough.
Well, perhaps,
yes.
But I think you have a winner.
With Bob Murphy.
Bob Murphy.
I think Bob Murphy is Mr. Darcy because to look at Bob Murphy, and I hope he's not on holidays in Apollo Bay listening, you wouldn't think he was an oil painting. And yet.
No, he's the one.
Yeah.
He's the one.
So Lizzie was a tricky one. Isn't that ridiculous that it's tricky to find a woman in public life who's admirable and intelligent and... So my first pick was Quentin Bryce, the former Governor-General, because I've always thought she was wonderful. She was, when she was being inaugurated or whatever they do to Governor-Generals, her daughter brought along her child who was a bit restless and one of the ushers or whatever went to remove the child and she refused. Yeah. She said no. You know, he's here. We have children. That's life.
That's right. Women understand these things.
Yes.
Well, Quentin Bryce as Lizzie Bennett, yes.
Or maybe, this is a Johnny Come Lately, so you get to choose, Brian. Annabelle Crabb, you know, from...
I like Annabelle Crabb.
Or Tanya Plibersek, A Late Run.
Well, I was trying to squeeze in a sports journalist. Like Sarah Jones.
Oh, yeah.
From Fox Footy.
Oh.
Or Samantha Lane.
Yes, yes.
Samantha Lane. Samantha Lane. Would be my Lizzie Bennett, yes. But Annabelle Crabb.
Annabelle Crabb does that, you know, kitchen cabinet where she goes and visits people. And Sean McAuliffe did the most hilarious send-up of on his show where he had her riding up on her bike and she falls off. it is very sort of 19th century English, isn't it?
Yes.
I don't know, Brian. Well, we settle on, who do you think, Quentin Bryce?
Quentin Bryce. Okay. That's good, yes.
Jane was a bit tricky. Dennis, my partner, offered Vanessa O'Hanlon from the ABC Weather because he loves her, or Tamara O'Dine, who reads the news on the weekend, or both. Princess Mary of Tasmania.
All very good choices for Jane Bennett. All of them, yes, excellent.
Maybe Princess Mary. Bingley was who do you find in the modern equivalent? Like Bingley is just a nice man, you know.
A little bit easily persuaded by his assertive friend.
So I thought of that. I don't even really know him, but Grant Denyer, who does the...
he's a toothy one, isn't he?
Yeah, he does quiz shows and stuff. Mm. Or Hamish McLaughlin.
Now, just remind me, who's Hamish
McLaughlin? Hamish
McLaughlin
does,
footy.
Footy.
Yes. Hamish McLaughlin, yes.
Yes.
Or his brother, Gillon.
Yes, maybe Gillon. Yes. Mm. Wickham... Reminded me of a quad bike. That's Keating, isn't it?
Yeah.
All tip and no iceberg. And I thought either Wayne Carey or Shane Warne.
Oh, yes.
Probably Shane Warne, really.
Yes.
Mr. Bennett, Clive James, you know, someone who's got that sort of acerbic tongue.
Yes.
Mrs. Bennett, my favourite for this is Sophie Mirabella. I think she would have to, you know, the politician that she famously got Bronwyn Bishop into trouble for at her wedding. And she just seems to, you know, she said, what did she say in the last election? Something that,
you know, about... if you don't elect me, you won't get your hospital.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So
she didn't realise she was bordering on breaking the law. By saying that.
Definitely.
I wonder, what about Pauline Hanson as Mrs. Bennett?
Oh,
like airheaded, self-centred.
Brian, we're being very controversial today. Perhaps she could be Lydia.
Lydia,
I thought Kim Kardashian might have been Lydia. Because if you advertise you've got your $4 million worth of jewels and you tell people where you are and then you're surprised when you get burgled.
Oh, dear. And, of course, Lydia's the one who's forever chasing after young men in uniform.
Yes, yes. And she ends up with Wickham. And Kitty and Mary, I couldn't really think of anybody for them. But Charlotte was interesting. Charlotte is Elizabeth's friend, who is a lovely person and quite intelligent, but she's older and she has to marry someone. So she has to end up marrying the odious Mr. Collins.
Oh,
and so I thought Lucy Turnbull or Margie Abbott
Abbott. Margie Abbott as Charlotte. Oh, that is fabulous.
And Mr. Collins, the odious Mr. Collins, of course, he's the one that will inherit the house. That's the way the will, the descendancy had been written. So he's not loved by any of them. And he arrives and he's this pompous character who just speaks endlessly about his patron, Lady Catherine de Bourgh. And so I thought Eddie Maguire or Andrew Bolt.
Or Corey Bernardi. It's Mr. Collins. Or perhaps in Emma, Mr. Elliot, Mr. Elton.
Oh, Mr. yes. Elton. Yeah. and Lady Catherine de Bourgh could be Gina Reinhardt, of course.
We're talking, of course, about Pride and Prejudice.
I just want to go back to Helen Garner's essay again, How to Marry Your Daughters. She finishes with the ending of Pride and Prejudice. It's just her comment makes me laugh. So quoting now, and here she comes again, the relentless Lydia. Three pages before the end, she writes the newly married Elizabeth a truly outrageous letter. And she's quoting from Austen now. I'm sure Wickham would like a place at court very much. Any place would do of about 300 or 400 a year. But however, do not speak to Mr. Darcy about it if you'd rather not. Yours, etc. I sprang off my sofa at last, strode to the freezer for a slug of Absolute. That's her vodka that she has when she's impassioned about something. And raised my glass in silent respect. A toast to the Empress, Jane Austen. God bless Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy and the current of deep, warm, erotic attraction that flows between them. And long live the Lydias of this world, the slack moles who provide the grit in the engine of the marriage plot. For without them, it would run so smoothly that the rest of us would fall into despair.
That's from Helen Garner's Everywhere I Look. Wonderful. The third Jane Austen novel to be published was Mansfield Park in 1814, Fanny Price, a very, very likable heroine. Yeah. At the age of 10, is sent to the household of her wealthy aunt and uncle at Mansfield Park. She grows up with her four older cousins, but is always treated as the unwanted poor relation.
Yeah. It's the Cinderella story.
Yes, except by Edmund. And of course people fall in love with the wrong people. They have perhaps preconceived ideas about heroes and heroines, and then only later do they discover that people had no principles, or they're dishonest, or they're conniving or something, and then eventually they fall in love with the right one.
It's interesting in this one. Edmund is the one that sort of experiences the Pride and Prejudice. You know, he's the one that has to come around. Fanny is quite, she's quite consistent in her affections. Yes. He is the one that has to learn the lessons about making mistakes in judgment about others.
Yes. And, of course, we have a cast of interesting characters. Lady Bertram, a little bit like Mrs. Bennet, perpetually vague and distracted, lazy. Mrs. Norris, mean, counting every penny, refusing to set the fire in the orphan's room. And there's always Tom Bertram, the dissolute young man. His father despairs of him. One of the interesting little things about Mansfield Park is that there is a kind of a reference to the British slave trade.
Yes, that's right. He goes off, and there's been argument about whether it's, you know, Jane Austen just needed an excuse to get rid of him for a while so that the characters could blossom, because he's the quite heavy-handed father figure, or whether she was trying to introduce that idea of the ill-gotten gains of some of the British aristocracy.
There's a hint of it also in Emma, when Mr. Elton, the horrid clergyman, goes off to find a wealthy wife from Bristol. Now, wealthy family in Bristol, they'd be slave traders, wouldn't they? There's just a hint of it. And, of course, she's a horror, Augusta. She is a horror.
Her names are so unique. Men always have these long, multi-syllable, you know, very strong names, don't they? Like Wentworth or...
Yes, Knightley. In Emma, this Jane Austen said, I'm going to take a heroine whom no one but myself will much like. And she does. Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, rich, and needing to learn quite a bit about herself and about life. So she is quite vain and makes a few mistakes, interferes with people's lives, makes a mess of things. And here's an interesting thing, Lee. Her father, Mr. Woodhouse, who indulges her, spoils her rotten, is I had to learn this word. He's a valetudinarian.
Mm-hmm.
He's a hypochondriac who's actually sick. There is such a word, yeah. Her neighbour, of course, is a bit older than her, is the redoubtable Mr. Knightley. When I used to teach this to VCE classes at Bendigo TAFE, adult classes, all the women used to always say, "Oh, Mr. Knightley, I want one." then her young friend Harriet, who might have married young Robert Martin if Emma hadn't interfered.
Yeah.
And then is it her cousin Jane Fairfax who comes to stay? And unbeknownst to Emma, Jane Fairfax is engaged to one Frank Churchill, and Emma has all sorts of preconceptions about, doesn't like Jane because Jane's more accomplished than she is herself, likes Frank, flirts with him a bit, not knowing that he's already engaged. Mm. And, of course, the odious Mr. Elton, who wants to marry Emma. She wants him to marry Harriet, and he goes off and marries the equally horrible Augusta. And then there's the Mr. and Mrs. Weston, her dear friends, who try to advise her. And the interesting one is Miss Bates, Jane Fairfax's aunt or whatever. Miss Bates is an example of the woman in Jane Austen who has not been able to make a good match.
Mm.
She's destitute, really, and dependent upon the charity of her family and her friends. And,
yeah, it's such a strong idea throughout, yes, isn't it, the vulnerability of women in the world of that time.
Yes. Wonderful, wonderful book, and I quite enjoyed the Gwyneth Paltrow portrayal in the film.
Is that Clueless? Is that the one?
That was Emma. Gwyneth Paltrow was Emma. But Clueless, the Alicia Silverstone film, is based on Emma, 1995 comedy, and that is brilliant. Mm. It is brilliant. It's wonderful. It's wonderful, Clueless. It's a work of art. And Kate Beckinsale also starred in the BBC or the ITV film, Emma.
If you think, 90s. You know, hearing you go through that, the narrative, lines of the narrative again, it's really obvious, isn't it, Jane Austen playing with the same sort of ideas,
yes,
about we think we're so good at judging people and, you know, we really aren't aware of our own prejudices. And I was just thinking this before, there was a really nice bit that I reread in Pride and Prejudice where when Darcy is being critical of her family, she realises then in all honesty, it's true.
Yes.
That she
her mother
thinks,
is an embarrassment.
Yeah, that's right. And Lydia is an idiot.
Yeah.
She thinks that herself. But, you know, it's that sort of idea that we know best and we're easy for us to be critical of others but not accept that criticism when it's made of us.
Yes. Now, Lee, as we did with Pride and Prejudice, let's adapt Emma to our world. Now, Emma is youthful, proud, lively. Oh, I was thinking perhaps of Lee Sales of the 7:30 Report.
Yes. Well, I think that's an inspired choice, although I don't think Lee Sales would have interfered quite as much as that.
I think she'd be flattered by the choice.
But it's a good example of, a woman of character.
Yes, yes. And Mr. Knightley, the romantic hero, I was thinking Nick Xenophon.
I think you think more highly of Nick Xenophon than I do.
Well, honestly, where are you going to find a romantic hero in Australian public life?
I know, it's tricky.
They're thin on the ground.
Yeah.
I haven't thought about this one, but Harriet, who's the sort of naive, dopey young friend, played in the film by Toni Collette.
Ah.
Well, Toni Collette.
She played that character. Yeah, we can't presume to know what she's like as an individual, Brian.
Surely it'd be somebody like that. Mr. Elton, though, he's the, like Mr. Collins in Pride and Prejudice, he's the horrible clergyman.
Yeah, she had it in for the clergy, didn't she?
She did. She did. Although in Mansfield Park, Edmund's a clergyman. Yeah. And in Sense and Sensibility, Edward Ferrars is a clergyman. Mm. So, but I think she certainly had a few scores to settle. Her own dad was a vicar, of course.
Yes. Jane they Austen. Used to say that you know, the second son was for the church,
yes,
wasn't it?
And that's right.
I remember hearing that as a joke about Ted Bailey. Mm. He was the one that should have gone to the church.
So for Mr. Elton, now we want somebody who's self-righteous and odious. Well, self-righteous and offensive. I'm thinking of people in the federal parliament.
Yeah,
spring
it's the
to
easiest
mind.
Thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, the
Tony Abbott is very self-righteous, isn't
he? Yeah, and always
and he's
managing
religious.
To insult somebody.
Yeah.
Or to say something utterly tactless. Just before we leave that, I've got an example of the free indirect speech which Jane Austen uses in her books, and this is from Emma. Emma sat down to think and be miserable. It was a wretched business indeed, such an overthrow of everything she'd been wishing for, such a development of everything most unwelcome. Doesn't seem remarkable, but Jane Austen was the one who introduced that kind of narrative into English
literature. It's also that sort of the way she personalises the emotion that they're having. Like, I think it was before that one about, she become, oh, hang on, I've got a quote from, I think it's from Pride and Prejudice again. She wanted to persist with the enjoyment of all her original dislike.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, that yes. I've got my set and I'm quite happy with it. I'm sticking with it.
Just for our listeners, if you're still not quite convinced to pick up a Jane Austen book, there are some lovely books around, like this one by Dominique Enright called The Wicked Wit of Jane Austen. And so you can just dip in and out of it. It's so funny. Lee, Jane Austen had died by 1817, and Northanger Abbey and Persuasion were published after her death.
Yeah.
Gosh. And Northanger Abbey I think perhaps it had been written early, but it's like her Juvenalia stuff. It's the most overtly comic novel she wrote.
Yeah.
And it's a clear parody of the Gothic novels, which she and her sisters would have read and which were so popular.
And she's always assuming things have gone bad or there's something sinister and it ends up being absolutely nothing.
Yes, harmless. Like, she imagines that the gentleman has murdered his wife, and of course there's, and his son, General Tinley, Tilney.
Right.
She imagines that he must have murdered his wife, and his son, of course, takes great offence and smartens her up somewhat. As usual, there's always a manipulative, scheming character, Isabella. Catherine, the heroine, is in training for a heroine. Thinks her life is like a Gothic novel. But to be fair, she sees the best in people and she learns from her mistakes.
If you did a sort of profile of the different, protagonists in Austen's novel, she does really cover all the phases of her own life, what she was like as a child and that imaginative world, and then, I can't remember which is the one where the she's 27, the character.
Oh, Persuasion.
Yeah.
Yes, Anne Elliot.
Yeah, and you get, that's a sort of, looking at life when you're left on the shelf.
Yes.
And then she gets a second chance, it's,
Yes, yes. It is published in 1817, and I think the title was probably coined by her brother, who was her executor, because she had called the manuscript The Eliots.
Mm.
But it's about the pressures and choices facing young women, number of situations in which people are influenced or attempting to influence other people, hence persuasion. One of the things about persuasion is that there's a very strong influence of romantic poetry, so she would have been well acquainted with Wordsworth and Coleridge by this stage. Anyway, Anne Elliot's 27. 7 years ago, she had been persuaded by a friend, a good friend, Lady Russell, to break her engagement to Frederick Wentworth. And now, 7 years later, Frederick Wentworth turns up on her doorstep. Mm.
People do turn up in Austen novels.
Yes. And there's a really moving part. I remember it from the film. And Anne Elliot says something about women, as distinct from men, women don't give up on their feelings.
Yeah.
And Captain Wentworth overhears her saying this and then realises she's talking about
him. Yes, that's right. I remember that now.
Yeah. A lovely, lovely book, Persuasion, by Jane Austen. Gosh, what a woman she must have been, Jane Austen.
I was talking to one of our colleagues here at 3ABR, John Smith, who's just returned from an overseas trip and had been in Bath.
Oh, yes.
He was talking about, you know, you can go and do all these sort of Jane Austen tours, but, it, you know, for anyone who's travelling, it is a fabulous thing to read a novel or non-fiction text of the place you're going to, because it just really enriches the experience if you're there and you're wandering around and imagining the characters that they've talked about.
That's right. And many of the buildings would still be there, of course.
Mm.
Yes. So much more we could do, Lee. I've got places marked in all these books and so on, but we're kind of out of time. I just want to mention in Northanger Abbey, Catherine and Isabella become friends, and on rainy days, what do? They read novels.
And, Perfect point.
She goes in chapter 5, it is, if you happen to have a copy of Northanger Abbey with you, and she goes on as the author saying that, well, other people may criticise the novel as a frivolous and so on activity, but not I, you know. It contains all the wit and wisdom and experience, and I heartily recommend it to any young ladies reading. You know, it's the most wonderful little joke. And she's a delightful woman, Jane Austen. Lee Kelly, thanks for coming in. It's been fun.
Yeah, no, it just reminds you of, like, I feel like now I should go home and read Sense and Sensibility.
Yes.
I can't, Brian. I've got so many other things I've got to get through.
Oh, no. Well, maybe we'll have to have a week off soon and catch up on our reading before we come back with the book show. But just to foreshadow, we are planning a cookbook show.
Yes, I thought, you know, it might be interesting to look at some other different form of writing, because the thing about cookbooks is they still sell really well. And yet, if you want to a recipe for anything, you just Google it now and up it comes.
Yes.
So there must be something about the way modern cookbooks are being written that's different to Cookery the Australian Way, where it was just the recipe, that's all you were getting.
Yeah.
You know,
I wonder
that
what
people.
That is it?
Well, I suppose the
connection,
you know,
to the writer or something.
And it must be, I think there must be something to do with the fact that Australians are such great travellers. I mean, you only have to look amongst your own society. Mm. People are always travelling, going places. And you know, it's lovely to have a cookbook from where you've been.
Yes.
And, you know, you cook up something from it and remembering the meals you had when you were travelling. It's maybe, I don't know. But it's certainly a very popular genre still, and it seemed to be interesting to explore that.
And I might put my mind to the sporting book. That's a possibility. And there is the U3A is running a physics course at the moment. So before that's over, we'll have Les Cameron back and possibly Dennis Sharples to talk about physics.
Yes.
All right, this has been the Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. Hope to catch you next time. Goodbye.